Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 11, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing a recently published book titled Business and the Roberts Court. My name is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us three great scholars. The author and editor of the book, Professor Jonathan Adler from Case Western Reserve University School of Law. And we also have two of the chapter authors, Professor Richard Lazarus from Harvard Law School and Professor Brian Fitzpatrick from Vanderbilt University Law School. I will turn it over to Professor Adler, who will get us started with opening remarks. After opening remarks and some discussion from the speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Jonathan, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to be here to talk about business in the Roberts Court, and I'm certainly thrilled to have Richard and Brian on the call as well to talk about their contributions to the book. Basically, the idea of this book was to try and explore in greater detail the question of whether the Roberts Court is a pro-business court, as it has sometimes been described, and perhaps even more importantly, if that were the case, what would that mean? What does it mean to say a court is pro-business? What does that tell us about what the court is actually doing, how it decides cases, how we might predict how it will decide cases in the future? The idea for the book came about because shortly after John Roberts and Sam Alito were confirmed to the court, we began to see a lot of news stories and commentaries making the case that the Roberts Court was pro-business or was open for business. Perhaps most famously, Jeff Rosen had a piece in the New York Times Magazine entitled Supreme Court Incorporated, which argued that the Roberts Court seemed to show a particular soft spot for the interests that were brought to the court by the business community, both in terms of the cases that the court agreed to hear, as well as in how it decided cases. And subsequent articles and even some empirical studies have made the case that the court appears to be more sympathetic to arguments made by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce than it used to be, and that business litigants are more likely to win cases than they were in the past. And so the idea behind this book was to look critically at this hypothesis to get a sense of what it would mean to say the court is pro-business, but then also try to unpack it. Because while it's certainly true that the business community has won some important cases in the Supreme Court since John Roberts has been chief, it's also true that the business community has lost some significant cases. And so the idea is to truly, really understand what's going on. Why is it that the business community wins some cases and loses others? We thought it would be useful to get a group of prominent scholars together to look at this question. And the resulting book has a couple chapters that are empirical and do some quantitative assessments of the pattern of decisions, a book about the role of the Supreme Court Bar and advocacy that Richard's going to talk about in a minute, and then a series of chapters looking at different doctrinal areas. Brian's on some procedural questions, but as well as chapters on antitrust, environment, labor law, securities law, and so on. In terms of what the book finds, I think certainly the bottom line that I draw from the inquiry is whether or not we think of the Roberts Court as pro-business in part depends on how we define what that means. I don't think that taken together, these chapters show that the court particularly is particularly concerned about business as business. That is to say, the presence of a business organization or businesses in a case doesn't seem to be doing the work. But there are certainly some areas in which the court has doctrinal commitments that work to business's advantage. And then there are some other areas where that is less clearly the case. And I think the book shows that some of the quantitative empirical studies that have been done really give an incomplete picture of what the court's doing in this area, in part because of the limits of those sorts of analyses, that merely tabulating the win-loss record of the business community in the court, for instance, may miss other things that are going on. Perhaps most importantly, the fact that not all cases are created equal, that in any given period of time, in a given subject matter, there will be some cases that have a much greater impact, that do much more to make the law more or less favorable to business interests than others, and that if you don't take into account the qualitative difference in cases, as well as the doctrinal baseline against which those cases are decided, that you can't really say much about whether or not the court is creating a more or less business-friendly legal environment. And just to give one example that I use in my chapter on the environment that helps illustrate this, we can look at the court's three decisions relating to climate change as that showing the limitations of quantitative analyses. The court decided Massachusetts versus EPA, American Electric Power versus Connecticut, and Utility Air Regulatory Group against EPA, three climate change cases in the Roberts Court. I think pretty clear that the business community lost one of those cases, Massachusetts versus EPA, won one of those cases, American Electric Power, and then split one of those cases, the UARG case. So quantitatively, we would say that this is a win, a loss, and a draw, that the business community has pretty much held its own. If we look at the votes of the justices, because American Electric Power was a unanimous win for the business community, we would say the business community actually got a clear majority of the votes available in these three cases. But if we look substantively at the effect of these cases, we see that Massachusetts versus EPA was a really dramatic case in the sense that it not only made it easier to file claims based on or alleging standing based on climate-related injuries, it more significantly gave EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And whether one thinks that decision was correct or incorrect, that clearly was a very dramatic expansion of the EPA's regulatory authority, giving it far more regulatory power over businesses, particularly industrial firms, than it had had before. And the other two decisions, the loss was a pretty clear reaffirmation of prior precedent on displacement of federal common law causes of action, and the UARG case modestly cut back really around the edges of what the court had done in Massachusetts versus EPA. So the combination of these three cases together as a doctrinal matter and as a matter of the regulatory environment in which business operates is a dramatic shift in a pro-regulatory direction, a direction that most of the business community was against. And that's something that a quantitative analysis would not pick up. I should add that this has nothing to do with whether or not any one of these cases was correct or incorrect, but just as a descriptive matter to understand what the cumulative effect of the court's decisions were in this area, a qualitative analysis that looks at what the court's actually doing tells us a lot more about the cumulative effect of those cases than merely tabulating them as wins and losses. The other thing that I think is important, particularly for the Roberts Court in thinking about how we measure whether it's pro-business or not, is thinking about the baseline. I think it's fair to characterize this court as largely a status quo court, not in all areas and not uniformly, but particularly in areas related to statutory interpretation and regulatory policy, and certainly in areas related to tort litigation. The court tends to be fairly minimalist. It tends to take small steps, and it tends to be very hostile to efforts to dramatically change the law. That means it's very useful for the business community when the business community is playing defense, when the business community is trying to fight back a innovative theory that plaintiffs' attorneys have developed to advance a certain type of class action. The Roberts Court has been very sympathetic to arguments against recognizing new legal theories that would facilitate additional litigation, but it's generally been very reluctant to embrace theories that would dramatically scale back the amount of litigation that we already see. So in areas like implied causes of action, the court has said pretty consistently, we're not going to recognize new ones, but we're not going to get rid of the ones we've recognized in the past either. So whether or not that's pro-business depends on how we think about businesses' interest in the status quo and maintaining things as they are. Lastly, I want to say there are some areas where it's not clear that the court is particularly pro-business. Certainly compared to some of its predecessors, the Roberts Court has not really built on, for example, the Rehnquist Court's due process cases that held that excessive punitive damages could be considered a due process violation. The one case the court, the Roberts Court, had on that, it confined it to questions of federal common law in maritime or admiralty context. And in areas like preemption of the Dormant Commerce Clause, the court has been mixed in terms of what its willingness to strike down a state regulation. So overall, I think, you know, certainly what I draw from the book is that there are ways in which the court has been or has adopted positions that are favorable to business, particularly its skepticism of plaintiffs' litigation and its hostility to innovation in this area. But it is also a fairly status quo court, which means that the business community has not, at least to date, been able to use the Roberts Court to try and push back regulatory or litigation holdings from the past that it would like to get rid of. And it's also been quite deferential to Congress, which has meant that when the business community is capable of getting what it wants out of Congress, this is not a court that's likely to disrupt that accommodation. But at the same time, if the business community loses significantly in Congress, this is not a court that's likely to upset that either. And then, of course, the last thing is this court is still a work in progress, and we're obviously going to see changes in the court's personnel in the years to come, and that could certainly change the way the Roberts Court approaches these issues in the future. So I will stop there, and I will turn it over to Richard to talk about his chapter on the role of advocacy in how the court decides to hear cases related to business and how those cases come out.
Thanks, Jonathan. All right. In my brief remarks, I really want to touch on three things. The first is the rise of the Supreme Court bar in the past few decades. I'm really focusing on the private sector Supreme Court bar. That's first. Second, why I think that rise is significant. And third, whether I think it's a good or bad thing, the rise. So the first is on the rise of the Supreme Court bar. You have to sort of go back three decades. Almost exactly the case. September 1986, it's really just about a week or so before then Justice Rehnquist is sworn as Chief Justice. He's asked publicly if he thinks there's such a thing as a definable Supreme Court bar. And Rehnquist quickly and quite easily says no, there's no such thing anymore. And what's fascinating is he was absolutely right in September 1986. There wasn't. There was then nothing like the early 19th century where we had the court arguments and cases dominated by a series of really outsized personalities. These are the folks who argued, you know, case after case after case, hour after hour after hour, you know, luminaries such as Daniel Webster, William Pinckney, William Work, even Francis Scott Key, who's now known for other things, was a very famous Supreme Court advocate of his day. And then it wasn't even in 86 like the mid-20th century. Then you had the New York City law firms. It's a real private sector Supreme Court bar dominated by three former Solicitor Generals, John W. Davis at Davis Polk, Charles Evans Hughes Jr. At Hughes, Hubbard & Reed, and Tommy Thatcher at Simpson & Thatcher. But as right as the Chief Justice Rehnquist was, or Chief Justice-to-be in about 10 days, when he made that comment at 1986, he failed to appreciate what everyone then failed to appreciate, which was that the seeds of the reemergence of a Supreme Court bar were being planted really at the very moment he was talking. Rex Lee, who had been Solicitor General in the first administration of Ronald Reagan, he left being Solicitor General in July of 1985, and he took with him to Sidley and Austin a young attorney who had been assistant to the Solicitor General named Carter Phillips. And the two of them built in October term 1986, because Rex had to worry about recusals for a year, they built a stunningly successful Supreme Court practice for the first time in the modern era, representing private sector paying clients. This was some pro bono work. These are paying clients, and he did case after case after case. And the other firms sort of took notice, especially the Chicago firms took notice, because they didn't want to be outflanked nationally by Sidley, First, Mayor Brandon Platt, Stephen Shapiro, a former Deputy Solicitor General, responded by hiring two Deputy Solicitor Generals, Ken Geller and Andy Fry, and one Senior Assistant Solicitor General, Kay Oberle. He hired them all as partners. In 86, hired everyone as a partner, a lateral partner. They had not been in the private sector. Brought them all as partners to create a Supreme Court practice. And then it was off to the races. Bruce Ennis at Jenner and Block really started promoting his Supreme Court practice and bringing in two young lawyers, Paul Smith and Don Vrilli. Kirkland Ellis responded eventually with Ken Starr and a young protege named Paul Clement. The California law firms were not to be outdistanced here. Ted Olson created the practice at Gibson Dunn, Walter Dellinger at O'Melveny & Myers. The D.C. law firms responded to the competition, with E. Barrett Prettyman bringing in a young John Roberts, Wilmer Hale bringing in Seth Waxman, Covington bringing in Bob Long, every firm in these places. The Texas firms responded to the competition by creating their own Supreme Court practice. Boutique Supreme Court practice firms started to spin out, like Robbins Russell and Kellogg Huber out of Mayor Bland, Mayor Brown. The state SG started to create their own, really for the first time, Supreme Court practices, with state SGs coming to play major roles. People obviously like Ted Cruz. Among others. The law schools started creating Supreme Court clinics, mostly as spinoffs affiliated with law firms. So it's just an extraordinary rise, and wasn't there since 1986, but it was there about 10 years later. Now, why do I think it's significant? The reason I think it's significant is these folks, the private sector, they dominate the Supreme Court docket. They get cases granted at much, much orders of magnitude higher rates than other people. They dominate the grants. They dominate the oral arguments. They have dramatically increased the amicus practice, because if they don't have the cases themselves and want to file briefs, the number of amicus briefs. A lot of Supreme Court practice before this happened was all dominated for most of the 20th century by the Solicitor General's Office, the U.S. Department of Justice. They outgunned everybody. They had the know-how. They had the expertise for Supreme Court practice. No one else did. And what the private sector bar did is they evened the playing field with the Solicitor General's office. And some might say they even, in many instances, best the SG's office. The SG's office sometimes comes at risk of being the farm club for the private sector bar. You go to the SG's office for a little training, and then you get hired by the private sector bar instead. And the private sector is often led by former SGs and former alums of the SG's office. The result is the briefing before the court is much better than before. If you actually look at the briefs, which I've done in the 60s and 70s, there's no comparison in terms of the quality of the brief. That includes the quality of the briefing by the SG's office. The oral arguments are much higher quality than before. And that takes us, I think, to the third question. Is a good thing or a bad thing? My short answer is it's mostly good. But then with some identifiable concerns, which suggest that maybe some reforms or redress of some kind is warranted. As a bottom line, my view is better advocacy is good. Better advocates lead to better decisions. That's good. And that's why the justices like it. If you ask them, they'll tell you. They like this repeat player Supreme Court bar. They like briefs they can rely on. They like advocates who can answer their questions. The oral argument is much more sort of useful to the justice than it is when you've got someone up there who can't answer anything. Years ago, you go to an oral argument in the Supreme Court, it was not unusual to see Justice Byron White in the 80s be flummoxed once again by an unprepared advocate and literally turn his chair around and just rock, signaling that, you know, there's no reason for you to continue talking anymore. The quality of advocacy is much, much better. So what are the concerns? They're twofold. My primary concern is at the jurisdictional stage, and that is I think that the private sector Supreme Court bar really exercises, just because of the quality of their work, disproportionate influence on the court's docket. They skew the cert grants. They are great advocates, and the court does not structurally commit the time and resources necessary to really vet what they're granting on. And they're unduly influenced by very good advocacy by young clerks who don't really know what they're doing at that stage, and the justices who aren't spending hardly any time at all at the cert stage. As a result, they get sold bill of goods at the cert stage, not caught by the court. They grant cases they shouldn't grant. That's often why businessmen will lose on the merits by a large margin, because they got sold something at the cert stage. And no less importantly, they likely miss cases that they could have been granted because the other folks don't have the resources to catch the justice's attention, and the bar has been raised by these good advocates. On the merits, once the court grants a case, I'm less concerned generally about skewing on the merits. Once it's granted, I think the justices, clerks are all in. And they can distinguish advocacy as a general matter from things which are persuasive on the merits. So I'm more worried at the cert stage than on the merits, but what the court grants, how the court spends its time, what issues are more or less important, makes a difference for the country. I do nonetheless worry that there are certain areas where the playing field is so skewed in terms of the quality that it may actually affect the result. And that can be because procedurally issues aren't raised, arguments aren't made that need to be made, and the justices, you know, procedurally have to have these issues and questions presented, often in the op, or else they're out of bounds. Questions aren't answered. I think that can happen. It may happen more in the Trump administration, where the SG and the private sector are aligned on the same side. When they're not aligned, then I'm less worried about that happening. I think it happens, though, more systematically in criminal defense cases. I think it happens in some pro bono cases. I think that in areas where the private sector bar is conflicted from pro bono, so they don't tend to do it, it's more likely to happen. And environmental cases, I think, are a fairly classic example where that tends to happen. In a lot of death penalty cases, you can always get a great Supreme Court private sector bar attorney to take on those cases. They'll jump all over to do them. But there's some areas they can't do because they conflict with their clients, and those are the money cases. You're not going to see them do it. Just to mention a couple quick things in response to what Jonathan said, maybe we can talk about it later. I agree completely with his analysis of the cases he mentioned. The only caveat I'd put is Massachusetts versus EPA is such an outlier there. I mean, if you look at Massachusetts versus EPA, when the court granted cert in that case over the opposition of the SG, it was the first time the court had done that, granted an environmental case over the SG since Sierra Club v. Morton in like 1971. They don't take those environmental cases when the environmentalists have lost. They take them when industry has won. So it's a great case. I love that case, but it's a real outlier of a case. The cases I look at for the industry bar influence, Supreme Court bar, is a case called Burlington Northern, a Superfund case, and Michigan versus EPA, a Clean Air Act mercury case. Those are cases where for the first time, the Supreme Court bar itself moved into environmental law, and they got the court to grant cases they wouldn't have otherwise have granted. They got the court to grant cases. The Superfund case, that was Marie Mahoney and Kathleen Sullivan, wrote great cert petitions. The court had for years denied review on those issues. They got them granted, and they won. Michigan versus EPA, again, you had terrific private sector attorneys, and it was Supreme Court bar. It wasn't the environmental attorneys anymore, Supreme Court bar. They petitioned. They know how to get the justices to pay attention. They got it granted, and they won. And that's all. Thanks. All right. Brian.
Is it my turn?
It is your turn, Brian.
This is Brian Fitzpatrick at Vanderbilt Law School, and I'm here to talk about the Roberts Court and the civil litigation cases. Jonathan's view that the court has basically been a status quo court, I think, is most challenged when it comes to the civil litigation cases that the court has decided, whether it's in class actions or arbitration or the pleading standards, which I'm going to talk about today. I think the conventional view among scholars and other commentators is this is the area the court has been the most aggressive about changing the law to benefit corporations. And I think that the cases that they point to as Exhibit A for that are the two cases I'm going to talk about today, the Twombly case and the Iqbal case. I suspect all of our listeners are familiar with these cases. They are, in the few short years since they've been decided, they are the most cited Supreme Court cases in American history. They touch every single civil case that's filed in our federal courts. And most commentators look at these cases as Exhibit A of the conservative judicial activism of the Roberts Court. My view is, did Twombly and Iqbal change Supreme Court doctrine? Yes, they did. Are they conservative judicial activism? No, they're not. I think people have been jumping up and down far too much about these cases, and I want to explain a little bit why. Just to review briefly what Twombly and Iqbal did, Twombly and Iqbal basically changed the pleading standards in federal court, at least as far as the Supreme Court doctrine was concerned. It used to be you just had to put enough in your complaint to put the defendant on notice about what the case was about so the defendant could prepare an answer. That's called notice pleading. And in Twombly and Iqbal, the Supreme Court says that's not enough anymore. You have to plead enough factual allegations in your complaint that a judge believes your claim is plausible. And the reason why the court said that is because if we let you get past the motion to dismiss, then you get to discovery. And discovery is very expensive for everyone. And we're not going to let you get to discovery unless you have some chance of finding something there that's worth all the time and expense of being there. And so they said your claim has to be plausible. So is this a change in Supreme Court doctrine? You know, as I've set it up, yes, it is. This plausible thing pretty much came out of nowhere. The court for many decades had basically said the merits are irrelevant on the motion to dismiss. So I think the critics are right when they say the Supreme Court has changed things. But I think the critics are quite wrong when they say that this is conservative judicial activism. And I'm going to say that for a few reasons. Number one, Twombly, the first of these two cases, the one that kicked everything off, Twombly was a 7-2 decision written by Justice Souter. Justice Souter is many things, but a conservative, he's not. And the reason why Twombly was 7-2 is because the problems that the expense of discovery have caused in our civil litigation system have become so plain that they cannot be ignored even by the left. The rules of civil procedure, and Rule 8 in particular, which goes to the pleading standard, were written in 1938. In 1938, we didn't have computers. We didn't have defendants that were large multinational corporations with data in every file drive. In 1938, it may have made sense to let plaintiffs get access to discovery by, you know, writing their complaint on the back of a cocktail napkin. But now the discovery, because of all the electronic data, costs millions of dollars to go through, it no longer makes a lot of sense to let plaintiffs put defendants on the hook for it with nothing but the back of a cocktail napkin. And so, you know, Justice Souter understood that in Twombly. And it's not just Justice Souter and Justice Breyer, who also joined the majority in Twombly, but many, many, many district courts well before Twombly had been doing what Twombly said to do for decades. There are some very famous law review articles by a professor at Ohio State named Chris Fairman, where he laid out a long time ago that lower courts had been elevating pleading standards to save defendants from having to go through expensive discovery for no reason. And so this problem has been well known for a long time, that we needed to rebalance power between plaintiffs and defendants in light of changes in discovery costs. Lower courts have been doing it for years, and in Twombly, the Supreme Court largely ratified what had been going on for a very long time. So there's not much of a change in the actual practice of law, even though there may have been a change in Supreme Court doctrine, because these problems are so plain, everyone knew something had to be done. And in fact, as confirmation of that, you know, there's been a lot of scholarship, empirical scholarship, that tries to discern what effect Twombly and Iqbal have had on case filings and case resolutions. There's probably been at least 12 empirical studies that have been done, and we've got meta-analysis of the empirical studies now too. It's been consumed a lot of scholarly time. And you read these studies, and the conclusion you come to is Twombly and Iqbal do not appear to have had much of an effect at all. And the reason it has not had an effect is because district courts were already doing it. And so that's the first reason why I think that these charges of judicial activism on the conservative side are not warranted by Twombly and Iqbal. If there was any activism, it was bipartisan, and it's been a long time in coming. Secondly, the other reason why I think the judicial activism charges fall down with Twombly and Iqbal is what we're talking about here is not striking down a piece of legislation that Congress has enacted. You know, when the courts change things and strike down legislation, you know, we worry about the democratic ramifications of unelected judges overstepping their bounds. That's what judicial activism is all about. What we have here is the court reinterpreting one of its own rules of civil procedure. The United States Supreme Court has been delegated the responsibility to write the rules of civil procedure. If the court wants to change its own rules, it has that prerogative. Now, normally when the court changes its rules, it goes through a cumbersome process of advisory committees and standing committees, and then it transmits the rule change to Congress, and Congress has 7 months to pass a law invalidating any change. That's the normal procedure. But the Rules Enabling Act says very clearly that that committee procedure is not required to be followed by the Supreme Court. They don't have to use their little committees if they don't want to. They can do it on their own. Now, it is true they're supposed to transmit the rules to Congress before they make any changes, but all that does is give Congress the opportunity to pass a bill signed by the president to stop a change. But Congress always has that right. Congress has that right right now. They could pass a bill right now to undo Twombly and Iqbal. And so, again, the court has not done anything untoward by doing it through a judicial opinion as opposed to the rulemaking process, because they weren't required to use committees, and Congress has the same rights to undo what the court has done now that they would have had the court transmitted something to Congress before the effective date. And so I think that a lot of the agitation over Twombly and Iqbal has been unjustified. It was time to do something about discovery. Everyone knows it was time. And the Supreme Court's changing its own rules, not congressional prerogative. The better question, I think, and where I think our efforts would be more fruitfully spent, is talking about whether the mechanism that the court decided on to rebalance plaintiff-defendant power is the best way to do it, is the best way to police who gets a discovery and who doesn't get a discovery, a higher pleading standard that a court asks itself, is the case plausible or not? And then if it is, you get all the discovery you normally do, and if it's not, you get nothing. That all-or-nothing approach based on an assessment at the very beginning of the case, is that the best way to solve the problem of discovery costs. And, you know, my own view, and I think a view of a lot of scholars, is the pleading standards are kind of an imprecise way to decide which cases are worth discovering, which cases are not, and how much discovery they get. Again, it's all or nothing. It's the very beginning of the case. It's the decision is made by a judge who doesn't know much about the case. There's going to be a lot of errors, both in the positive direction and the negative direction, type 1 and type 2 errors. And a lot of scholars think the better way to deal with discovery costs is to use the invisible hand of incentives to regulate access to discovery. So there's a proposal by one of the defense bar organizations, the Lawyers for Civil Justice. They have a proposal to switch the current discovery regime from what they call producer pays to requester pays. So instead of plaintiffs requesting documents of defendants and defendants having to pay to produce them, the LCJ says, why don't the plaintiffs have to pay for whatever it costs the defendants to respond to their request? Requester pays. And the argument is, if plaintiffs have to pay for what they ask for, instead of externalizing those costs, they'll be a lot more careful about what they ask for. We don't have to worry so much about plausibility and pleadings if plaintiffs have incentives not to over-request in discovery. I have a more modest proposal that I put up on SSRN recently that adopts a requester-pays model like that only if plaintiffs lose their cases on summary judgment. And so in my view, what we should do is say this. Plaintiffs, you can get to discovery if you want to. You can ask for what you want. The defendant will pay to produce it. But if you don't find anything in discovery and you lose your case, then if you lose it on summary judgment because you don't find anything in discovery, then you've got to reimburse the defendant for all those costs. And so, again, these are proposals that try to use incentives, the invisible hand of incentives, to make people make more responsible choices and to incentivize people to avoid running up costs in discovery. So those are some proposals that are out there. But wherever you end up on what the best way to deal with the discovery cost problem is, again, I think there's very little dispute that there is a problem, and I think it's hard to fault the Supreme Court for doing something about it, just as lower courts have been doing something about it for many, many years. Thank you very much.
Jonathan?
Yeah.
Jonathan?
Yes.
Can I actually make a comment? Is that all right, just to relate
sure.
what Patrick was just saying in terms of my topic?
Yes.
On the merits of Twombly, whether Twombly was rightly or wrongly decided, I have no particular opinion. It's not my area, so I'm not questioning that at all. I do think the Twombly litigation, though, is a great example of what I was talking about, and that is the advantages and effectiveness of a masterful private Supreme Court bar. This is almost like their poster child of success. If you look at that case, what you'll see is, one, it gets granted. And those kinds of issues are really hard to get granted. The court doesn't normally take that kind of a pleading question. The reason it gets granted is you've got the private sector Supreme Court bar just all over the case. You know, the petitioner counsel of record is Michael Kellogg, a colleague of mine from the Solicitor General's office. Michael is a spectacular lawyer at Kellogg Huber. And you have Michael aligned with the who's who of Supreme Court bar is filing briefs on his side. You got Michael Kellogg, Richard Toronto, Steve Shapiro, Paul Larkin, Paul Clement, Tom Hungar, Bob Long, Roy Englert. I mean, it's a powerhouse of laying out all the damage and all the risks of a particular kind of pleading approach. On the other side, you don't have any Supreme Court expertise at all in the case. You've got Cohen Milstead, it's an attorney, great, wonderful antitrust trial attorney. He's done a couple arguments in courts of appeals. He's not a Supreme Court expert. And they have not done the job the other side has done of putting in the amicus. There's one amicus brief filed by not a Supreme Court expert, by the American Antitrust Institute. Again, not talking about the broader programmatic questions being raised about civil procedure. No one who's going to try to educate the court, which I presume someone could do, a good lawyer, Supreme Court lawyer, about what this will mean in this much broader area beyond antitrust, about pleading rules. The court's not hearing that. Becomes a very simple case. It's why it gets resulted the way it does. The only folks who dissent is going to be like your one justice who might have some expertise in civil procedure and as a plaintiff's attorney, and that's going to be Justice Ginsburg. So I'm not saying the decision is right or wrong, but this is exactly the reason why the business community wanted an expert Supreme Court bar. It has generated incredible yields, as Patrick says, in many areas of law beyond the one it was brought in. And I don't think that if you ask David Souter, he knew any idea when he wrote it that it would have the kind of impact it would have. So this is what good advocacy does. It leads to these kinds of decisions. I think it's a good example. Again, not saying it's wrong, not saying it's right, just saying it shows the power of really good advocacy on one side.
One thing I would add to that and also add, I think it relates to some of the other cases that Richard mentioned before, is that one thing that Supreme Court advocates have become really good at is not merely identifying how to frame a case for purposes of getting the court to accept review, but also recognizing the sorts of arguments that the court is really interested in. And just to use the environmental area as an example, one thing that's very conspicuous about the Roberts Court, like its predecessor, the Rehnquist Court, and Richard has an article on this from, I guess, UCLA several years ago, is how the court doesn't talk about these cases as environmental cases. It's not interested in hearing them as environmental cases. It's interested in hearing about statutory interpretation. It's interested in hearing about federalism. It might be interested in hearing about process. And if folks that spend their time focused on the Supreme Court recognize that that's how the court wants to hear about these cases, that the environmental subject matter is incidental. Someone that comes to the court thinking, well, you frame this case perhaps the way you do in a trial court or the way you might in the court of public opinion, is going to have a hard time because the court's not very receptive to those arguments. And I think that's something you definitely see in the environmental cases. Massachusetts versus EPA, which you mentioned before, is the only majority opinion, I think, since John Roberts has been chief, in which the majority expresses any concern or even attention to the environmental subject matter of the case. There are a couple dissents, I think also by Justice Stevens, that address the environmental context of these cases. And that's just notable because it tells us a lot about the way the court's looking at these cases. And one of the things that I found interesting in editing this book is that you see a similar phenomenon in other subject matter areas. So Adam Pritchard's a chapter on securities law, for example, points out that courts have taken a lot of securities law cases that have been presented to the court very cleanly and well for the court to accept them. But there's very little evidence in the opinions that the court really has securities law specific substantive commitments that, like the environmental cases, it's viewing these as regulation cases, statutory interpretation cases, cases about when you find implied causes of action, not cases about securities law. And again, that's something that the Supreme Court bar is certainly attuned to, but it's also interesting in terms of how the court approaches cases that may be of particular interest to people in particular fields.
Jonathan, just a quick ironic update on Mass versus EPA, because I was very involved at the cert stage in the briefing of that case for the Massachusetts and the environmental petitioners. I think one reason it was granted is we worked very hard not to pitch the case as an environmental case, and we briefed it as an ad law case. And actually, if you look at the oral argument of the case, in the brief, you'll see it's all about, this is an important question of administrative law. There was no stressing of the environmental stuff. And so we were all quite pleasantly surprised, wholly apart from the fact that we won, that then Stevens, on his own initiative, turns it into as this huge thing about the environment. And we knew the climate was important, obviously, but we were pitching it as an ad law case. And Stevens took it and ran with it as an environmental law case, talking all about climate change.
All righty. I think we're, unless Brian, you wanted to add something, we're ready for questions.
Okay, very good. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. One question I had, and I know both Professor Lazarus and Professor Adler touched on it a bit in the remarks, but what impact do you think the new Supreme Court justice will have on the Roberts Court with regard to business cases? I know it's kind of a broad question and involves speculation, but would you like to fill that in a little bit in terms of your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll say it time. First, I think that an initial appointment to replace Justice Scalia, the effect in the run of most cases is likely to be small in business-related cases. I think that's true for two reasons. One is because a lot of the cases that the business community has won in the Roberts Court have not been 5-4 decisions. They've been fairly lopsided. Cases like Regal versus Medtronic or Twombly that was mentioned before, or American Electric Power, and so on. And so the change of one justice in those cases is unlikely to have a big impact. In the 5-4 cases, certainly in most of them, I think we expect a Trump nominee to be fairly similar to Justice Scalia in terms of his or her overall doctrinal commitments. There are a couple areas where I think we might see some differences. One is there are some areas where Justice Scalia was somewhat skeptical of arguments made by the business community. He was not always a pro-preemption vote, expressed skepticism about the Dormant Commerce Clause, skepticism about efforts to constitutionalize certain doctrines like punitive damages, which I mentioned before. It's hard to know what a replacement will feel about those sorts of questions, but that's an area where you could see some difference. The other area that I think is harder to really know what the effect will be is on the internal workings of the court. One case that one of the last things that the Supreme Court did before Justice Scalia died, for example, was to grant a stay on the Clean Power Plan. This was quite unexpected. And I think it's also an example of the phenomenon Richard pointed out, in the sense that the petitions for the stay were pitched perfectly in a way that I think was really hard to do, since it's a very unusual thing for the court to issue a stay on a regulation like that. I tend to think that Justice Scalia not only was the fifth vote for that stay, but likely behind the scenes played a role in pushing the court to consider that. And it's hard to believe that a junior justice would have that sort of impact. And there's no reason to think a new justice would have the same concern for that sort of issue that Justice Scalia, I think, did.
Just a couple of quick comments. I agree with everything Jonathan said. One thing I'm going to be looking for is whether the person is an insider or an outsider in terms of institutional impact. It's more likely to be an outsider. If you look at the last several appointments, Roberts, Alito, and Kagan were all members of the Supreme Court Bar, all very well known to the justices that way, and known very well known, and socially, professionally, members of the bar. Sotomayor was not. Obviously, the president-elect is looking more to outside people, outside those circles. So we're not seeing Paul Clement's name. We're not seeing Brett Kavanaugh's name. We're not seeing Jeff Sutton, who was SG for Ohio. These are really terrific Supreme Court lawyers and judges. And they're not, but more in the inside, people who all know them quite well. And that's not who's dominating the list.
Okay, very good. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star and then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One programming note, our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for this Friday at 2 p.m. That call will discuss the Supreme Court's decision in Samsung v. Apple. Gentlemen, the lines are currently still wide open. Are there points, additional points, Professor Adler, that you'd like to bring out about the book, or maybe particular areas in either Professor Lazarus or Professor Fitzpatrick's chapters you'd like to discuss?
Well, I mean, certainly one issue that often comes up when talking about business in the Roberts Court, and we have a chapter in the book by Joel Gora at Brooklyn Law School on this, is how to think about Citizens United, which certainly freed corporations from certain restrictions on their ability to finance advertising and messaging related to campaigns, although not contributions to campaigns themselves, but independent expenditures that could support candidates for office. Joel makes the case, and I certainly found this persuasive, that Citizens United really shouldn't be thought of as a business case, and that the court didn't approach it as a business case. The court approached it as a speech case, and that this is a court that has a fairly maximalist view of speech, largely driven by Justice Kennedy, and that the same impulse that has led the court to strike down, you know, a law prohibiting lying about your military service, laws restricting animal torture films, laws restricting truly offensive protests at military funerals, is the same impulse that led the court to strike down portions of the campaign finance laws, and that it's an example that a lot of times when business community gets something it really wants, the fact that the business community is affected or a beneficiary of a ruling might be incidental, that the court is sometimes focused on other doctrinal commitments, in this case, a very expansive view of what sort of speech is protected by the First Amendment, and it is beneficial to business in certain contexts, but not because of its business, because of something else.
Okay, very good. I guess I will issue a last call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star then the pound sign.
We answered all the questions.
It seems that way, at least for today. See, the audience was challenged, and we do have a question. Let's go to that question now.
This is Jack Park. It's not so much a question as an observation. Citizens United, consistent with what was said, became more of a speech case when the Solicitor General responded to a question saying that books could be banned under the campaign law.
Can I make a quick response? It's Richard Lott, a very insightful point. I mean, from an advocacy point of view, I'm interested in that case because that is a case which could easily have been decided very narrowly when it was first argued. And for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, I think that's a case where the advocacy affected the outcome. The SG took a very expansive view in the first argument of the case. They did not were really willing to narrow their position at all when invited to by the court, and that led to the re-argument. That led to the court to say, all right, we can't decide this one narrowly, and they re-argued the case in the fall and ended up with a much more sweeping ruling than I think they would have done if the SG had given them a narrow position in the first instance.
Thank you.
Okay, gentlemen, I think that, given our time constraints, that's probably our first and only question of the day. Are there any concluding remarks you'd like to leave the audience with?
Jonathan wants you to buy the book.
Yeah, well, of course. It's available on Amazon. It's available direct from the publisher through Oxford. So we certainly would love folks to buy the book. Other thing, just for folks that are aware, other contributors to the book, I mentioned Adam Pritchard and Joel Gora. We have Brad Jundeff from Santa Clara, Mitch Pickerel from Northern Illinois, Tom Lambert from Missouri, Rick Hills from NYU, Matt Bodie from St. Louis University, in addition to the folks on today's call. And it's, you know, it is the first book to really try and tackle this question. I don't think it'll be the last word on this subject, and certainly the court will likely do things in the years ahead to either add additional evidence in support of some of what's argued in the book, or perhaps to challenge that. But I certainly hope people agree that it's an important topic, and thinking about how the court deals with these cases reveals a lot about how the court operates and what it prioritizes.
Again, excellent, gentlemen. Again, the book is Business and the Roberts Court. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our great guests for speaking with us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.